You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, July 17th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, the director of Gasland 2, Josh Fox, on his film Gasland 2, and celebrating a victory for those who've been fighting fracking in the Delaware Basin. Also on the program, more news on that filibuster deal. A big win for those of you who appreciate the National Labor Relations Board and the EPA and the Labor Department. And on and on. Also on the program today, McDonald's with a helpful hint on how you can live on minimum wage if you're working for them. Good news for New York Staters who don't have health insurance or who have been paying a ton for health insurance. You're going to pay about 50% less if you get a health insurance on your own. Yes, thank you, Obamacare. Also on the program, a Christian conservative political shop in disarray. We've got the inside story. Well, we got it from BuzzFeed, I think it was. But they have the inside story. Also on the program today, what do you do if you're running for office as a college student and you have a history of conservative demagoguery? Well, you cheat to win, and then apparently you go to jail. All that and more on today's program. Your calls, of course, later in the show. Just a little bit of housekeeping here, folks. I have the app on my phone as we speak for the Majority Report. We're going to be doing beta testing in the next week or so. We have all the beta testers we need. Members only will be beta testing. But that and the Roku app is also in beta testing mode. So stay tuned. The app is so fantastic. I can't even begin to tell you how excited I am about it. But hopefully you can hear it in my voice. It really is. The app is fantastic. You're going to love it. It's a great way to listen to the program. And we have now finally moved into the 21st century, almost. Only 13 years too late. Okay, this story, as long as we're talking about wins, I think we had talked some time ago about what was happening at Cooper Union. This is a college, a university in New York, which was set up by Peter Cooper years ago to provide free education for college students so that they were not burdened by student loans or the cost of college. They go into professions not driven by the need to make money. And sadly, because the Board of Trustees and the administration of Cooper Union wanted to be an internationally recognized university, they decided that they needed to sell off property, that they needed to build a big endowment so that they could have prestige, and that they would have to charge students $20,000 a year to attend. Well, after 65 days, a dozen or so guest lecturers, after 65 days, 50 students, give or take, who had occupied the office of the president, Jamshed Barucha, and they had started in early May, have now won their battle in exchange for an invitation for all sorts of people, but particularly students, to get on a search for a different means in which to fund the school. It's a big victory for these students. They camped out for 65 days, and their perseverance was rewarded. They're going to have an opportunity to force the university, the college, I guess, to find a different way of funding it, and hopefully return the institution to its roots. We need more of this. We need more. Cooper Union can be an example for the rest of the country as to why we need free higher education. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Josh Fox. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program the director of Gasland and Gasland 2, Josh Fox. Josh, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Sam. It's great to be on.
Now, the last time we spoke was about a year ago, almost to the day. You were on a train coming back from Washington, D.C. You had just been led out of a committee hearing in handcuffs. For attempting to the crazy notion that somehow that the hearing should be videotaped in some manner,
right.
And it's a scene towards the end of the film, and it really, in many respects, sums up the difference between Gasland 1 and Gasland 2 in terms of just how much our government our processes have been made opaque and yeah. In many respects because of the money from this natural gas and oil industry.
Go ahead.
Please.
Well, I think that's putting it mildly. I mean, what you're describing is there was a case that I had been following for 4 years, which is a case of groundwater contamination due to hydraulic fracturing in Pavilion, Wyoming. If you've seen either of the films, you know the amazing, iconic, real-life cowboys out in Wyoming, John Fenton and Lewis Meeks, who had water contamination. One of their water wells exploded with natural gas for 3 days. They had benzene in their water 50 times the safe level. EPA had come in, done a three-year study, and verified that their contamination was due to fracking, and it was a thunderbolt from this tiny little town, 150 people in the middle of Wyoming. Lo and behold, here it is, EPA confirming what everybody already knows, that fracking contaminates groundwater, that science was being attacked by the Tea Party head chair of the Science Committee in the House of Representatives, Andy Harris, and we could tell that this is what they were going to do, that the House of Representatives was going to attack EPA's science. So we wanted to be there after following this investigation for 4 years, went in to register to tape the hearing, as journalists do, as we had done many, many times, and consistently got rejected, and we figured out that they were basically barring our cameras from the proceedings because of the perspective of our films. That's a First Amendment violation. You're not allowed to say, no, you can't come in because of your opinions or your perspective. You could only say, well, we don't have room. No one else was signed up for this. I went in anyway, took my camera out of my bag, began to set up, and lo and behold, 18 police officers came in and arrested me. And I basically said to the hearing room, you know, this is a public hearing. I'm within my First Amendment rights, and I'm being taken out. They arrested me. And this is the kind of thing that sums up so much the conversation. Gasland 2 is an inquiry into another layer of contamination due to fracking, not the water, not the air, but the contamination of our political system. The first film is really about watching people light their water on fire and other water contamination and other environmental and health problems due to fracking. This film is really about the natural gas industry lighting our democracy on fire, and that every dollar that they inject into the political system is a contaminant in our democracy. And you watch over and over again in this film, it's a roller coaster ride of following families as they have scientific evidence of contamination, of they have real proof. And then at the regulatory level, at state level, at the local level, and at the federal level, time after time after time, enforcement and action and government change gets taken away from them by the immense pressure of oil and gas. It's not just money. A lot of it is relationships. A lot of it is the way in which the oil and gas industry will exert tremendous pressure on our elected representatives, on our regulatory agencies. And this roller coaster ride is, you know, every bit as shocking as watching the first film where you see people light their water on fire. In this case, you know, we're watching as the story gets controlled and retold by the industry instead of by the people. And in that instance, it was clear, Josh, no, you and HBO and your documentary crew may not tell the story of how we're going to attack science and the science committee. We're going to do this without public realizing it. And it totally backfired. After I was arrested, I was told that I was the first journalist to ever be arrested in Congress simply for attempting journalism. And then I spent the next 3 days on television and on your radio program and things like that, alerting people to the fact that this is what was going on. The disturbing footnote to this story is just a month ago, the federal government, the Obama administration, the EPA, handed over this investigation, the same one that I was arrested for, to the state of Wyoming, the state that was openly hostile to the science from the beginning, with a $1.5 million contribution to do the investigation from the company doing the being investigated itself. In Canada, a Canadian drilling giant is now paying for the investigation that's going to investigate them. I wonder how that's going to turn out.
That's
it is absolutely
stunning.
Jaw-dropping what the Obama administration has just signed off on, which is to basically hand the chicken factory over to the foxes, and those people in Wyoming are stunned. They feel they have no recourse. They've been pursuing this through the government for 4 years, and it's just incredibly upsetting and frustrating.
Yeah, I want to talk about that that element of the film in a bit. I mean, you started off the film, and I have to say, you know, we spoke yesterday in doing an interview for Ring of Fire that will air over the weekend. And, you know, we had started off the interview by saying that, you know, I thought that Gasland 2 was a little bit darker because of that element that you brought in, and just how now that years later there was a sort of a body of evidence, the way that it was being neglected and the way that this the implications it was for our democracy. And you start off the film by saying that, you know, the sequel's called Empire Strikes Back. But before we get to that, in some respects, the Jedi has already returned. You got some great news just yesterday when we had spoken about the Delaware Basin. Tell us about that.
Well, this is amazing. I mean, the real antidote when your government is being taken away from you is to reinvent democracy. And that's what the fracking movement has done, and has done that to great amount of success. Most successful where there hasn't been drilling so far. The state of New York, for example, the whole state, we were told 4.5 years ago that, you know, you're never going to stop the gas industry from coming in. These are the most powerful corporations ever in history. There's nothing you're going to be able to do about it. Well, that was wrong. New Yorkers organized in record numbers to keep out, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people commenting on the environmental impact statement, protests, acts of civil disobedience, constant pressure on Governor Cuomo, making this an issue that the New Yorkers simply won't stand down on and has prevented the gas industry from coming into New York State. The same thing has happened in the Delaware River Basin. 2 years ago, there was proposed regulations that would have opened up the Delaware River Basin to 18,000 gas wells. The river basin on the Pennsylvania side, now that's the watershed for New York City. The big reservoirs, the river comes out of those reservoirs and goes down to Philadelphia altogether, bringing water to 15, 16 million people in southern New Jersey and Philadelphia and New York City. That's the Delaware River Basin. They were proposing to put in 18,000 gas wells on the Pennsylvania side. The river's the border of Pennsylvania and New York. And the gas industry, Hess and Newfield and Chesapeake, had leased 80,000 acres in a massive lease done with a bunch of different landowners, 80,000 acres. The whole, my whole township was 60% leased.
And this
now, that
was
only 30% of the population. What happened yesterday is the gas companies finally cried uncle and said they were dropping their leases, and they said the moratorium that the people forged in the river basin was too much. They had outlasted them. They said, we're done. Goodbye. We're leaving. And they literally broke their leases. I do not know what the world looks like right now. The property across from my house was leased, and it was terrifying to think that at any minute this place could get industrialized and turned over. Now those companies have, with their tail between their legs, disappeared, and it just shows the power of what happens when people can, when people organize. And similar things are happening like that in Colorado. Californians Against Fracking just started. In the first 6 months, 100 organizations signed on to Californians Against Fracking. Their mission is a ban on fracking. It's, France just came out, and we ran Gasland on the TV in France and Germany last week. The French Prime Minister came out again and said, we're not going to have fracking in France in my term. Spain just banned fracking. We're seeing a movement internationally and across America that's very exciting, that's about taking our democracy back from these companies that would seek to just pervert it.
And we should say that, you know, it was those leases that were the impetus for your first film.
Yeah. That 80,000 acre lease was the same lease that we got. I mean, we were part of that leasing pool, and the terms were being worked out of it by, you know, when I was first working on the first film. It hadn't been signed by everyone during the first film. I found out, you find out at the opening of the second film, that it has been signed and that now the property right across from me is leased. And it's an escalation of things. And, you know, no one expected this. It is a huge moment, though, of victory, realizing that now all of a sudden we're talking about the Upper Delaware River. I mean, it's a small victory, but in a sense, it's huge, and it's something that we have to celebrate. And it's because citizens in the Upper Delaware, you go up there and you go in that region, you'll see those anti-fracking lawn signs. You'll see a whole lot of organizing of that population against this to protect what they had, to protect their land rights, to protect their property values, to protect their water, and also to protect the water for all those people downstream who benefit from the fact that those citizens are water stewards, and they should really be rewarded for that in that capacity.
And you know, the interesting dynamic really seems to be that those communities that got some type of balance of information. I mean, it seems to me that the strategy of these fracking companies was to go into a community and just overwhelm them and do it in a as quickly as possible and as forcefully as possible so that there was no toehold. And you see a state like New York that had the information, because Pennsylvania, sadly, was almost the guinea pig in many respects. That once armed with that information, it made the job for these fracking companies that much harder to tear apart communities. You cover in Gasland 2 the audio that came out from I guess it was a whistleblower or somebody went in to a conference of fracking companies on how they go in and attack a community using psyops. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, the gas industry was getting an enormous amount of negative PR, and you're absolutely right. They want to come in all sweetness and light. When they arrive at your doorstep, they're going to say, oh, it's a lot of money. It's basically just a fire hydrant in the middle of a field. I mean, you won't even notice we're here. Couldn't be more deceptive. They don't mention the fact that you drill thousands of wells. Each one of these wells has a pad of 1 to 5 acres where the land is just completely destroyed. There's access roads, truck trips, air pollution, water contamination. They're not upfront about any of that stuff. And you're right. They want to come in without people really knowing what they're up to, and then all of a sudden your community is industrialized and you are living in hell. And this was starting out in the West, and people in the West have been known about this for many, many years. Pennsylvania, as you said, rolled out the red carpet. Governor Ed Rendell, come on in, destroy the state. Just do this. That's fine. We're not even going to look at it, you know, from an environmental impact statement, which is what New York did. But the gas industry was getting all this negative PR. All of a sudden, people start to understand fracking. People can light the water on fire. There's this film. Every news station in the country was running those clips and starting to embrace and talk about this issue, because all of a sudden it was New York City's watershed. It wasn't about these obscure communities that aren't in the media spotlight. It was a huge amount of territory in 34 states. The oil and gas industry has leased more land than the total land mass of California and Florida combined. Wow. That means they own a land mass about twice as big, because all the adjacent properties are affected by what they're doing. So they held a conference about how they, had to do damage control. And in that conference happened to be two bloggers from Earthworks. One Texas Sharon from Earthworks recorded a conversation that was an open conversation, part of a conference, where Matt Pizzarella of Range Resources, a major operator in PA and in Texas and other places, came out and said, "Well, we've successfully hired PSYOPs officers, psychological operations officers, newly returned from Iraq and Afghanistan to write local laws and to be used against landowners organizing against the gas industry in Pennsylvania." Psychological operations are to manipulate the hearts and minds of a community when you're in war. The military it's illegal for the military to use psychological operations against Americans. But here they are brazenly saying, yes, we're doing this to, divide communities. It was a jaw-dropping moment. And then all of a sudden, Chesapeake gets up, and then the representative from Chesapeake gets up and said, and describes landowners. These are people who are peacefully organizing and doing a democratic process, crying out for an environmental impact study. He characterizes them as insurgents. And then the guy from Anadarko, the PR representative from major oil company Anadarko, gets up and says that what the gas industry should be doing is downloading the counterinsurgency manual. This is a 300-odd-page manual for, Iraq and Afghanistan. It has descriptions of how to detain people, exploiting a single narrative. All sorts of – I mean, you should download the counterinsurgency manual, because it's seriously – interesting. but you know, that they're characterizing this in terms of war. It was reported quite a bit, but I don't think to the level it needed to be. And then all of a sudden, you know, you realize that that they have a mentality that they're keeping secret from us, that when you see all those natural gas ads on the television, American energy independence, gas is cleaner than coal, all these PR slogans about putting over on the American people a campaign to drill 1 to 2 million new wells in the United States. That's at the high end. That's one well per 150 people. This is a hard job. It's costing hundreds of millions of dollars in PR to try to promote this strategy of drill the United States to Swiss cheese. And meanwhile, behind the scenes, they're sitting here talking about insurgents and psyops.
It is shocking, and it is one of those communities that you really focus on is the plight of the people in Dimmock, Pennsylvania, who were overrun by these wells and then found their water supply completely destroyed. And there's a really long saga of how they're just simply trying at this point to get public water so that they can drink, and they can and you've got people in their homes who are sick, and really in many respects, I mean, this is the story of one of the stories in your piece about the betrayal and how our democracy on both a local and then a state and a federal level has been so corrupted by the influence of these companies. Just tell us the plight of what happened in Dimmock, and please, with an emphasis on what Ed Rendell did, because, you know, this guy is paraded around as a on the progressive, the so-called progressive cable network, and it really speaks to where his heart lies, or I should say his wallet lies.
Well, Ed Rendell right now has personal financial ties through the private equity firm that he works for to the natural gas industry. And he goes out advocating for further drilling without disclosing those conflicts of interest, which he's been caught on a number of times. But when he was governor of Pennsylvania, he was an advocate for drilling. There was no environmental impact study. It was roll out the red carpet. And water contamination episodes and people complaining sprung up all throughout Pennsylvania, from the southwestern tip near Pittsburgh all the way up to central PA, north central PA, about 3 hours drive from New York City. You know, people, Dimmick was the canary in the coal mine on New Year's Day of 2009. One of the people in Dimmick, their water well spontaneously combusted. It filled up with so much methane that it blew up. It threw the concrete casing up into the air. They came home from whatever they were doing on New Year's Day and saw that their water well had exploded. And then all of a sudden people started talking and it's, oh, well, my water turned black and my children are feeling nauseous and my animals are getting sick. And people started to put it together and they realized that their water was flammable, that they had other substances in the water, and they called the Department of Environmental Protection. No one had done anything, though. There was nothing happening until a guy named Lance Simmons, who's in our film, came to PA and said, this is a disaster area, went to Governor Rendell and said, this is a right of Pennsylvanians to have clean water. We need to build these people a water line. And all of a sudden, once Rendell got involved, there was a water line, presto changeo. But this was at the very, very end of his term, and the water line was proposed. It cost $12 million. The gas industry attacked and attacked and attacked, held public meetings, fostered a startup group called Enough Already, landowners telling them that it was going to be taxpayer money for these 18 families, and all of a sudden, like, fostered this kind of huge fight in the town. When Corbett was elected, Rendell and his Department of Environmental Protection secretary made a deal, a backroom deal with the gas companies without consulting the families, give the families a cash settlement instead of building the water line. The water line would have set a precedent for water replacement in Pennsylvania and throughout this country. If you contaminate a town's water, then you're going to have to pay for permanent public replacement. The gas industry didn't want to do that. They gave a much lesser amount to these families. The families rejected it. They said, no, we don't want money so that we can move. We want water. And then they brought so Ed Rendell and John Hanger made this deal and then disappeared. Tom Corbett comes in. We appeal, and the Dimmick families, to the EPA. EPA comes in and finds, lo and behold, groundwater contamination, but doesn't release the tests to the media and comes out with a statement that says, oh, the water in Dimmick is safe. This destroys the Dimmick families' civil case, and the Dimmick families to this day don't have safe, clean water. There are some of them, Scott Ely, who's in the film, is still pursuing, his court case. And, he's one guy fighting a huge oil and gas company. And then it was discovered that Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell had actually gone to the EPA, and this was related to a different case, at least that's what we know about, in Texas, and lobbied Lisa Jackson personally to drop a crucial investigation involving Range Resources, the same company that I just mentioned that was using PSYOP techniques in Pennsylvania, not the company in Dimmick. But he was lobbying the government as a former governor on behalf of the gas industry, to drop an investigation into water contamination, a precedent-setting investigation in Texas. I mean, it was like when we found these emails, it was like, well, what? Are you kidding me? Ed Rendell, the former governor of PA, just went to try to screw citizens out of an investigation in Texas on gas and on, but this fit a pattern, because here we were watching the Dimmick families petition to try to get action, and then a backroom deal is cut to sort of quiet it all down and make it go away. This happens over and over and over again.
Let me ask you this. How you say the EPA did the tests, but they claimed publicly they said there was no problem, but the tests said otherwise. How do you know what those EPA tests are?
Well, EPA, like all governmental agencies, is not one monolithic thing, nor does it necessarily even call the shots for itself. Before the election started, EPA had come in to Dimmick to do a full groundwater sampling. Now, I was on the phone with these guys when their tests started to come back. These are the families, the first 11 families. I knew six of those families. On a Thursday afternoon, they're calling us saying, yep, EPA has confirmed. We've got explosive levels of methane. We've got polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. We've got all this stuff that's not supposed to be in the water. They were feeling vindicated. Friday morning, a desk statement went out. Now, these were tests that hadn't been released to the public, you know, and I hadn't even seen them. Friday morning, a desk statement comes out from EPA, Demix water is safe. They didn't release the tests. I called up EPA, said, what are you guys doing? They said, well, we're not releasing the test because of the privacy issues of the family. I said, well, you've never done that before. You've always released results to the public. You've got to show us the scientific results. And they were like, we'll get back to you. So I drove to Demix for 3 hours and got the tests and saw, sure enough, explosive levels of methane, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, volatile organic compounds. 5 of the 7 contaminants that EPA was looking for were in those groundwater samples, plus methane, which was all about in the first place, was the fact that their water was flammable. It was a shocker.
So to be clear here, wait a second, just to be clear, the EPA sends the families a report that expresses what's in the water. The tests show the existence of all of these contaminants, but then the EPA just puts out a press release and says it's all clear. They were basically assuming that there's no way for those tests that those families have to really see the light of day in any type of public and meaningful way.
Well, to be honest, once the press picks up a story,
right,
you know, and the Associated Press picks it up, and you have a statement from EPA, under today's pressure of deadlines and the way investigative reporting is not, you know, as the norm right now, you're going to reprint the EPA's press release, and the EPA says the water is safe. This was a Friday morning PR, you know, release that said this. Now, I knew that this wasn't the case because I had talked to the people. And later, Abram Lustgarten at ProPublica, he investigated and he saw those tests and he said, yeah, and he wrote an article, so is Demix water really so safe? I went to EPA and had a closed-door meeting, a meeting that I was told I could not record, with Bob Sussman of EPA. And I said, well, we've got a problem here. You said this water was safe, and we have these tests that show that it's not. He looked at me straight in the face, and he goes, we never said Demix water was safe. I said, this is the press release right here. Look, the problem right now can be characterized in a very simple way. When the election started, all of a sudden, gravity starts to go upwards. You know, policy starts leading the conversation instead of science. If we're going out, as Lisa Jackson did, and aggressively investigating fracking to try to come up with science that shows either way, one way or the other, is it yes or no, what the citizens are saying, they're coming up with real hard evidence, real science that says that the citizens are right, water is getting contaminated in all these different ways. You know, if that's not the report you want, what it seems, and this is the story of Gaslin too, is you shelve those reports, you bury those reports, you don't allow the press or the media to see them, and then you proceed with the plan. And the moment when all this turns, I'm sorry to say, is the moment when the president comes out and says in his 2012 State of the Union address, largely recognizes the first campaign speech of the election, that he's advocating for natural gas. Yeah. And when you see that embrace of the natural gas industry in the president's speech, all of a sudden these investigations just do an about-face. Things disappear. We can't find evidence. Investigations going on in midstream stop and are gone, and citizens are left shrugging in the lurch.
And you've got low-level
happening in the public eye, nakedly.
You've got low-level EPA workers going to the homes and saying, I know that publicly we're saying your water's fine, don't drink it.
Well, this is exactly right. I mean, EPA mid-level scientists and people who are doing these investigations, these are people who care enormously about what they're doing, care about the environment, are good scientists, and, you know, they went to the citizens and said, all right, well, head office says your water's fine. We'll hook up your water well. Turn back around and go, don't drink your water. It's not safe. Don't drink it. We can't tell you anything more in a court of law. I would deny it. But I'm telling you right now, human to human, don't drink your water, off the record. People in there, you know, Scott Ely and Demick says, nothing's off the record. This is my living room, you know, and went to the press and said, EPA told, and the same thing happened in Texas. You had people in Texas, mid-level, who were interested in investigating this, saying, all right, well, the investigation's closed, been settled, off the record, don't drink your water. This is where what happens, and, you know, I would like to call on people at EPA right now and say, come forward. I've had lots of conversations with people at EPA who are incredibly frustrated, incredibly disappointed in how they watch when the scientific work that they're doing gets upended by policy changes. We shouldn't be living in a society in which, you know, we disregard science because it's politically inconvenient. We're in a big problem right now with groundwater contamination in the United States. We have a big, big problem with climate change in going forward into the future because we are not allowing the science to make policy. The policy is being created by the powerful corporate interests who are these multinational oil and gas companies. That's not going to work if we want science to behave, if we want our groundwater to stay clean, if we want our planet not to warm. We have to start having science drive the conversation rather than lobbying.
There were two facts that you presented. I mean, the film is full of incredible amounts of rigorous data, but there were two facts that really stuck out for me in Gasland too. One was sort of on a micro level, and one was on a more macro level. On a micro level, basically you found that that the science says that when you drill a well and you put the cement around it to protect presumably the contaminants that are supposed to be in the well and the methane from the water supply, that the cement, the moment that drill, that well is put into the ground, you have a failure rate at the beginning of 5%, and then it just gets worse.
Yeah. Well, this is actually industry's own science. The gas industry studied the problem of well leakage and well failure because they're losing their product. You know, if you drill an oil and gas well, you spend millions of dollars drilling an oil and gas well, you want all of that oil and gas to get up to the surface so you can transport it and sell it. They're losing big amounts of that. A gas well or an oil well or an injection well is basically just a steel pipe thrust down into the ground that's many, many miles long or a certain degree long, surrounded by cement. That cement is like a gasket. It's supposed to prevent oil and gas from coming up the sides of the pipe where it can't really be controlled. If it comes up the sides, it might go into a void. It might go into an aquifer. It might hit a fault and shoot up to the surface. That hole has to be cemented around the sides. That cement is on average about an inch thick. It's cement. Anyone who goes and walks down the street, sidewalk, any place, can understand that cement cracks, especially if it's only an inch thick and it has to go 2 miles and it's subject to the pressure changes and temperature changes that are down there in the formations. The cement cracks very often. The cement fails at a rate of about 5% immediately upon drilling. And then over time, that cement failure rate, the cracking rate, increases so that after 30 years, you've got about 50 to 60% of these cement barriers failing. That means if you're drilling 100 gas wells, you're going to have 5 cement failures, 5 moments when there's the potential to contaminate groundwater if you're drilling through groundwater. So this is a very, dangerous situation because each one of those contamination episodes can contaminate a whole aquifer. You're talking about oil and gas and having a vector for carrying those all those things that are deleterious that are down there, salts, heavy metals, normally occurring radioactive material, volatile organic compounds, the gas itself, up into an aquifer through a crack in the cement. The industry knows this. The industry knows this because it's their own science. We uncover that science. In some cases, those were reports that were internal and industry documents that were not for the public. And in other cases, these were published results in scientific journals that were created by the oil and gas industry to try to deal with their problem from 10 years ago before this was incredibly controversial. But here you go. You have the results. These are the numbers. And they fit what's happening in reality. We know in Pennsylvania, for example, there are 6,000 Marcellus wells that have been drilled. And we have about 1,000 families right now petitioning to the Department of Environmental Protection saying we've got water contamination issues. DEP has verified that 9% of the Marcellus wells that are newly drilled in the last 3 years are leaking. 9% over the last 3 years are currently leaking. That's in line with the industry science and industry projections. This is real-world data of what's happening right now. And the engineers that are quoting this data, who are former advisor, Tony Ingraffia to Schlumberger, former advisor, number one fracking company in the world, former advisor to the Department of Energy, is saying, there is no way to fix this problem. You can't adequately prevent it, and you can't always fix it. The industry will come in, and it'll cost enormous amounts of money to try to fix them, but they don't always work. We have a family in Western PA who we are Central PA that we cover in the film, the G family, four generations on the same land. Their neighbors signed a gas lease. They were forced to abandon their property. The Shell oil company, Royal Dutch Shell, the number one most profitable company in the entire world right now, drilled a six-well horizontal pad right next to them. That family of four generations had to leave. They ended up signing a non-disclosure agreement. We suspect that they had to sell their house to Shell. Shell attempted to squeeze that gas well several times, three different times. Methane levels would go down for a day and then shoot right back up. They could never fix this leaking well. That family whose water was flammable, who feared what was coming next in terms of air pollution and the health crisis that would happen when you're living right next to an industrial drilling site, ended up having to leave.
Of course. They had no other choice.
The industry is not being honest and upfront about these things.
And when you destroy an aquifer, you destroy it. There's no
right.
taking, there's no filtration that you can do there at that point. Now,
yeah,
on a macro
you can't
level,
clean it, it's in the ground.
This
yeah.
speaks to President Obama's policy or notion that in some way natural gas, and we're being sold this, is a great bridge technology if we want to get off of fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And in fact, this is not better. We're told that this is better for coal when it comes to climate change, and that's not the case at all either. And there was one guy in the film, I can't remember his name, who had bought a special type of camera which could allow you to see methane
yeah.
leaking. It was fascinating. Tell us about that.
Well, the natural gas industry will come in and say, we burn 50% cleaner than coal. What they mean is that there's half of the CO2, the carbon dioxide emissions from burning gas as there is from burning coal. Now, that's true. And if in an ideal universe, that would make natural gas half as bad for climate change and greenhouse gas and warming than coal. However, methane itself, the gas itself, is a super greenhouse gas. It's 100 times more potent than carbon dioxide at warming the atmosphere in the short-term 20-year time period. So 100 times more. That means if you're leaking 1% of the gas, it's like burning the gas twice. What we're seeing now is leakage rates at the different parts of natural gas production and delivery that are far exceed 1%. In the field, we're seeing leakage rates of 4 to 9%. So where they're drilling the gas, they're venting off huge amounts of the gas in the field. Why? Well, when they frack the well, they pull out the water that they're using to frack, and in that crucial week, they're venting off. It's not connected to a pipeline. All the methane is a lot of it is venting off and exploding into the atmosphere, and there is a guy named Frank Finnan who is not a rich guy. He's a woodworker. His wife died early before they could spend their retirement fund, and he took $54,000 of his own money and bought a FLIR camera, a camera that can see methane that the naked eye can't see. Methane is invisible. And he did this and went all around the country shooting gas wells as they're leaking, and he has some astounding footage of what happens when the fracking occurs. You see this when flowback recovery occurs. You see these huge clouds of methane exploding into the atmosphere that you would not see with the naked eye. They just wouldn't be there, but you can see them through this camera that Frank Finnan spent his life savings on to protect his area. He's a Central Pennsylvania guy. His story's in the film. This cloud of methane erupting, and some scientists, Cornell, got together and showed that they anticipated that in the whole natural gas delivery system, Bob Howarth at Cornell, between 3.6 and 7.9% of total production was going to leak into the atmosphere as methane. That means you're 3.6 to 7.9 times, you know, worse than coal if you're developing frack gas. The gas industry, and what we're seeing in the actual scientific measurements in the field, 4%, 9%, as high as 17% in the Los Angeles basin where you have production and delivery, 17% leakage. That's the product going up into the atmosphere. The reason why is that in these processes, it's a gas. It's hard to control. That you have to be very, very strict in terms of how you're dealing with pipelines that leak or the fracking process itself, which is the gas coming up out of the well instead of getting that water into a pit, which is open air, and the gas is flowing out. You would have to put all of it in tanks. You'd have to all of it separate. It's much more involved process, and a lot of the operators don't want to do it. Here's the problem is when you're going forward and you're saying, well, we're going to go in the direction of natural gas to solve our climate problem, as Obama's speech is, no one's happier than me to watch Obama earnestly and sincerely want to tackle the issue of climate change. It's enormously important. It's the most grave threat that we face on the planet right now. At the same time, he has got the completely wrong plan. The plan to switch from coal to gas doesn't get you a climate benefit in the long run, and that's, or even in the short run, that's not good science. It's not good policy. We don't have the time. We're talking about developing natural gas-fired power plants that would be built for the next 50 years, 50 years of energy supply from this. That we don't have 50 years to solve the climate problem. We've got to go after this and deal with this now. We're talking about projections that show dire, dire consequences by 2042, in the next 29 years, getting to 2 degrees warming. This is not something we have that time to mess around with. The good news is renewable energy technology can solve all of our energy problems, can provide all the things that we need. We have to vigorously make that transformation as a society away from the toxic past, away from dirty fossil fuel energy, and towards renewable energy. And we could do that. Americans love a challenge. It would be the next boom in our economy. We would truly achieve American energy independence because it's the wind, it's the sun, it's these things that you have a very hard time exporting. You know, that could be the next revolution in technology. We saw cell phones change the world. The internet changed the world. We saw all these technologies come across and change the world. Renewable energy is waiting in the wings to be able to do this. It could happen very quickly, and all of a sudden, we can't do it now because the oil and gas industry is controlling the way that the government operates, and that is essentially the real problem. We need real leadership that's going to come out and say, you know, enough is enough. Thank you for the last 100 years of energy, but we have to move on now because to continue to do this would diminish our standard of living, would warm the planet, would do all sorts of terrible things that we don't want to see happen. We need to move on.
We've got just a couple of minutes, but I just want to talk because, you know, as you're saying this, it seems to me that there's also, and you know, to sort of to globalize this fight in terms of what we're seeing across a lot of different issues, and particularly in terms of our democracy in this country. You know, I saw a clip of you on Bill Maher. I don't know if it was a week or two ago or last week, and yeah, with Niall Ferguson, the one of the world's greatest economic wankers, as far as I can tell, and Jonathan Alter, who is one of those people who is self-proclaimed liberal but always defers to the establishment position, the vitriol that particularly Ferguson leveled at you, the resent, and there was some of that, yeah, from Alter. And, you know, Jonathan and I have debated on this program on issues like Medicare and Social Security, which the fault lines seem to be very similar. Although I think, you know, halfway through that conversation on Bill Maher, it seemed that you had turned Jonathan Alter. I was just struck by how much this came down to a fight that you clearly are incredibly well versed at this stuff. You've immersed yourself in this this topic for 5 years. It took only moments for you to really make a fool out of Ferguson in terms of his lack of knowledge, but the presumption that he had. I mean, calling you, just saying you're a documentary filmmaker, you have no right to talk about this. I don't know what you're doing on this panel. I mean, it was comedic, but it really was this sort of knee-jerk establishment pushback, yeah, against you. And I don't know if they have any skin in the game, but it was like protect the moneyed interests at all costs.
Yeah.
I'm just curious what your take on that.
Skin in the game is the right way to think about it. I think that we're living in two very, very different countries. A country that is involved in the front lines of extractive energy industry, which is fracking, mountaintop removal for coal, the tar sands development, the Keystone Pipeline, the Gulf communities devastated by the Deepwater Horizon blowout, and people who live outside of that. I think that when we're outside of it, we don't process this in a deep way. The oil and gas industry has always considered a certain element of the population expendable. in the face of their exploits? How did their coal, our coal, get under their mountains, type of thing? You know, and I think that there are pundits on both sides, conservative and liberal and however you want to term it, who get a issue sheet on an issue and look at talking points and then go out and argue them. And one look at Neil Ferguson, and I just knew that he had no idea what he was talking about.
Yes.
That he, and which, you know, that he had no real experience in doing this. And that as an investigator, I've been out there looking at this for 5 years as if my own life and my friends' lives depended on it. And that's really the case. And, you know, so one look at the guy, and I kind of knew that he was going to rattle off a bunch of talking points that didn't make any sense. But at the same time, the vigor that he went out there with, I think, undid him, because he couldn't defend himself. And then once somebody attacks your credentials, you know you've won the argument.
Right.
You know, once you start to get to ad hominem attacks, you know that it's kind of over. But at the same time, it is really scary because Neil Ferguson has written banner pieces for Newsweek and for other publications advocating for frack gas, when in fact it's just numbers on a spreadsheet and it doesn't translate into reality, it doesn't make sense. This is the distance often that, you know, on those kinds of shows that you have in between somebody who really has experienced this and knows firsthand and people who are called in to commentate or whatever. The problem is that that distance also exists in Washington, and it's exploitable. Our representatives, as hard as many of them try, don't always have that experience. They don't have that expertise. They rely on what's being told to them. And in this case, you know, Neil Ferguson is getting the same information from the gas industry and from economists and so on who are looking at numbers that don't really add up when you actually look at them, as the president is getting, as our representatives are getting. And when you're dealing with thousands of issues, literally, you know, you don't get the time. What we're doing right now is appealing. And as I did to Neil Ferguson, I said, look, hey, I'll tour you to these areas. I'll take you. After the show was over, we were having a drink, actually, with the whole Bill Maher staff. And I said, look, I'll take you to Central Pennsylvania. I'll take you to meet these people if you really care about it. You want to see what it's about. I got his business card, and I'm serious about that invite. In the same way, we're
well. You got
to
update
Obama
us on whether or not he takes you up on it. I mean, you know, the parallel between. I mean, this is a guy who it was attacking the notion of stimulus based on the fact that he thought that Keynes was gay and therefore childless because he thought he was gay and therefore did not care about the future. And that's why he was willing to promote stimulus. I mean, this is a guy who
But getting back to planet Earth for a second, we've actually asked President Obama to please meet with the scientists and families and engineers in this new film, the families who are emblematic of thousands of people who are suffering at the hands of this massive drilling campaign, the scientists and engineers who are going to say, look, this is not a solution for climate. This is part of the problem. It's a big part of the problem. These wells are going to fail. This is a huge water contamination issue. This should not be your legacy. We know that he's met and his administration has met with the natural gas industry many times. We're just simply asking, let us bring you this information in the same way that, you know, I've been trying to do this in a lot of arenas. It's like, look, let us educate you about what this really, really means. And then you go forward and say, okay, we want to do this
surely
or not.
Surely he must have heard this from Sheila
Jackson.
At least
that point, you've had the access.
I mean, surely he must have heard this all from Sheila Jackson, right? I mean,
From Lisa Jackson.
Lisa Jackson.
I don't know. I know that Lisa Jackson, very tellingly, resigned after the election was over. I know that she was really a champion of people who was trying to fight or investigate the industry in her way. I mean, the politics of regulation is always couched in a certain type of incrementalism. At the same time, you know, I do believe that she sincerely cared about these issues, and she was out there to try to represent the people. The Environmental Protection Agency shouldn't really be called the Environmental Protection Agency. It should be called the People Protection Agency, because that's what it does. It protects our environment from us being chemically and toxically harmed by industry that wouldn't care otherwise. And I think she was trying to fulfill that mission. I am very worried about the future of EPA. As I was extraordinarily saddened by watching it fall apart in the face of industry pressure during the filming of this new film.
Indeed. Well, Josh Fox, the film is Gasland 2. It's available on HBO. You can go to gaslandthemovie.com. Thanks so much for taking the time, and you know, congratulations on the fight in the Delaware watershed. And just,
thank you.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate the work that you do.
Hey, and likewise, it's always a pleasure to be on. I appreciate it so much. Thanks.
Thanks, Josh. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Head into the second half of the program. You can call 646-257-3920. See this movie. Get people you know to see this movie. I mean, I think this victory in the Delaware River Basin is huge because it does send a message as much to the fracking companies, but more so to essentially the power that people have if they band together and they continue to fight. I mean, the film is really it's a fantastic film. But it's also incredibly informative and in many respects inspiring. I hope there's going to be a Gasland 3, just where the Jedi does fully return. Folks, you can support this program by becoming a member at majority.fm. It will be so easy on this new app that we are developing to listen to the member show on your mobile devices, on your Roku. Please, if you have the financial ability to support this program, you like hearing 40-minute interview, 35-minute interview with someone like Josh Fox. I don't know where else you're going to hear it. I'm sure there's some place, but I don't know where it is. So if you want the show to continue, you appreciate it. Even if you don't want the extra 40 minutes, 50 minutes of material that you get every day, become a member, support the free show. You can do so at majority.fm. Also, of course, buy your crap through Amazon at our Amazon link at the homepage of majority.fm. Click on it, bookmark it, always buy your stuff there. And justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get a 10% discount. Number 646-257-3920. Our lines are open. You can IM me at Majority FM. Back in a minute.